Fox Markets podcast with Justin Waite.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 401 on the podcast today. Barry Gibb from Beaufort Securities talks about oil, macroeconomics, microeconomics. We cover a couple of IPOs and a small stock he sees potential in. Also on the podcast, executive chairman of Red Rock Resources, Andrew Bell. I submit his questions or your questions to him and he answers them. But also, like I say, I've got to say this, I do say it quite a lot. Please use this podcast as information only. Don't go out buying blindly any stock that's mentioned in this podcast. It's just a stepping stone for you to do research. You know, it's basically, I'm a stranger. Everyone on this podcast is a stranger. You wouldn't go buying stuff off a stranger normally. So please look into the stocks that we mention. And, you know, it's information and it helps research. And at the moment, you know, we're in a bear market. So things are grinding lower. We're technically in a bear market. So you have plenty of time to do research. You're not going to miss out. Stocks go up and down. And if you have any questions, please get in contact. And if I can get someone to cover the question, you know, if you struggle, someone on Twitter said you tell people to do their own research, but some people don't know how to do that. If you have any questions whatsoever, I'll field them to, you know, experts or people in the know, and we'll cover them off. So because this is just here to help. It's a free service. It's not investment advice. You know, it's information on which you base your decisions. But please, don't invest blindly in any stocks mentioned. Also, last day to get involved in the oil price sweepstake. Shuts at 4:30 on Thursday today. And so if you're not in by then, you can't make a guess this week. It's a double rollover. So go to foxmarkets.co.uk/OPS. And I think at the moment, we got $65 plus whatever, you know, the oil price is at midday on Friday or tomorrow. That's where we take the price from. So you'll be getting, if you get it correctly, spot on that price, you'll be getting in excess of $90. That's in sterling, of course. So we're just going to foxmarkets.co.uk/OPS. I also have today's stock with potential. Again, use it as a stepping stone to start your own research.
The Fox Markets podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast for the second time, it's Barry Gibb, research analyst at Beaufort Securities. Thanks for coming back on, Barry.
Good morning.
And I tell you what, quite a few people got in contact saying Barry was very good. And I said, well, listen, he's on again. So, you know, people are looking forward to your appearance, Barry.
Well, let's not set expectations too high. I must admit I've got a bit of a headache with these markets this morning. So that's thumping around my brain box right now. But I'll give you the insight that we've had so far.
Yeah, well, listen, you know, has anything changed? Are we still headed down? Has the market outlook brightened in any way whatsoever?
Brightened? I don't think so, sadly. I mean, undoubtedly, current market and economic conditions remain overwhelmingly complex. Structurally low and declining growth rates, high international debt and weak inflation. Well, it leaves basically the global economy exposed to any number of downside risks. And worryingly, within this, the central banks appear to have progressively lost out on their ability to curb this volatility. And that may remind you what it was like during the financial crisis not so many years back, of course. So really the situation is, right now, the pattern is for the mist, it might lift for a day or two, just like it did at the end of last month, and then only to drift back in again when the latest negative soundbite hits us. The overall message is, and this is really the same as last week, that we remain exposed to very, very low quality markets at this time, and that we're embroiled in a very thick patch of fog, and we can't see through it. Now, I think if I was looking for a hook on which to hang sentiment, the highest correlation has still got to remain with oil prices. Now, last week, for example, daily WTI, West Texas crude, and the S&P movements were reported to have a 95% correlation. And really, this is what's behind our slightly improved market situation in London today. WTI rallied about 8% during Asian trading last night, and this was based on, one, the weaker US dollar, and two, of course, unconfirmed chatter that the Venezuelan oil minister is presently, or has been, conferring with his Russian counterpart, and today they are planning to go ahead with a meeting with the Saudis, and that will probably, at least as far as the chatter is concerned, actually take place tomorrow. So, without a doubt, confirmation of an emergency meeting of the OPEC members to discuss a coordinated production cut will, and I mentioned this last week as well, undoubtedly set the futures on fire, and that will presumably push oil into a new higher trading range. That said, we would still need to be absolutely convinced that this exceptional correlation on the downside will remain true on the upside as well, in order for us to be sure that the bear actually has been frightened away. And of course, punctuating that with telling you only what you already know, if the rumor is not substantiated, and I think we'll have to hear that in the next two to three, in the first two or three days of next week, the fundamentals of oversupply and excess inventory will simply reassert themselves again. And I think the situation is we've got no chance of saying that scenario will disappear until perhaps nicely into the second half of 2016, because at least then we think the non-OPEC contribution will fall back, and that's really down to the US shale operators not doing the replacement drilling. And of course, if I want to look beyond that, I'm just going to saturate you with macro data, none of which is particularly nice. Of course, Monday's Chinese PMI, that was the lowest reading for 3 years. Of course, on the corporate front, BP itself reset expectations of oil majors, so they've taken a step back generally. Yesterday's poor US service sector data was behind the dollar weakness I've already spoken about. And of course, Tuesday's ISM data, well, that remains stubbornly below the 50 marker. Now, that's for the fourth month in a row. That points at contraction. And most worryingly, of course, the employment component in the ISM notched up its worst reading since June 2009. And why I ring the bell there is that, of course, we've got the all-important, the very important U.S. non-farm payrolls tomorrow afternoon. And if that's foreshadowing, I think then the 180,000 or so consensus, which we've seen out there, must be wide of the mark. That's the situation, and if that's how it comes out on Friday afternoon, then we're all set for another dull start to the new week next time.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I was watching, as in Bloomberg last night, and they were saying about the oil rally, and the only thing they could put it down to is the weak, you know, dollar, because of all these figures that's coming out, a week. And I thought that's not a good sign, really, anyway, in either way. Anyway, let's come back to this country, and, you know, Cameron has been meeting with the European Council there, talking about, you know, trying to adjust the rules with Europe, and, of course, there's uncertainty with this vote coming up. But what's any clarity there, Barry? What's happening with Cameron in Europe?
Oh, no, not particularly good reading. I think most commentators appear to think that Donald Tusk's paper basically read as Mr. Cameron's terms of surrender. Now, that's a bit cruel. That's hard, really. But inevitably, the detail will disappoint those who were still hoping for some sort of transformative outcome, if there was anyone out there still thinking that would happen. Whatever, the negotiations continue, and I think there might be one or two additional protocol changes. They could be proffered, maybe, over this next 4 weeks or so. But it's still 1,000 miles from the full-on treaty change that the fantasy was being suggested, what, just 4 years back? So, yeah, not a comfortable position. And I think for me, there are an awful lot of dangers in rushing the referendum vote itself. The media appears to be telling everyone the date is fixed for June. And yet, I routinely will go out there and try and get conversation with Joe Public. And Joe Public is more than happy to tell me that they don't even know how to spell Brexit, let alone have a reasonable idea of what the consequences would be. And I think you could say that of an awful lot of the financial community as well, if you read the financial press. And that leaves the wider media simply to sensationalize the issue. And what's the result there? We'll go into Q2. Everyone will be pointing thumbs down. Sterling will be the fall guy during this situation. And of course, by default, for no other reason than that, the US dollar will be the winner. I think it's also worth reflecting the fact that both Ireland and Denmark have both voted no in their own referendums. Of course, the EU simply doesn't take no for an answer, particularly from its junior members, and they simply come back each time with some appeasing revisions. Well, this may be the route the UK has to take, and of course, a wide-eyed EU will be concerned about the idea that the UK actually making a decisive move could kick off a more generalised breakup of the Union. And so I think if there was an initial no vote, they would then I wouldn't say rush, but at least within 12 months or so, come back with something more sensible. Either way, the bottom line for me personally is it's wrong to force the public to decide until the greater majority feel that they have a good understanding of the arguments, and so they're prepared to vote for it. And I think that's probably next year rather than this year anyway.
Yeah, well, do you know what? It looks like he's going to play hardball because, you know, the UK is still a big noise in Europe. But what I'm thinking, from a market perspective, this isn't good because we've got, like you said, weak figures from China, weakish figures from America. Now we've got uncertainty because of this Brexit. That doesn't spell good news for the markets because, as we know, the old cliche, the markets hate uncertainty. So it seems like surely we're not going to get a rally this you know, at any point this year, are we? For the next 6 months anyway.
It's hard to imagine what will make it rally. The only thing I can point at right now, given the fact that we're not going to get a complete reversal of the cautionary macro tone, is going to be OPEC. So I think OPEC is going to ride to our rescue. Or let's say OPEC is the only party right now that can ride to our rescue.
Okay, let's try and fit in focus on something a bit more positive. Any stocks you're looking at, the IPO market, what's out there, Barry?
Let's say about IPOs, well, that was one of the areas that we were talking about last week. It might be the place to go because these ones that were so advanced in the pipeline couldn't be switched off. And of course, the underwriters of these really have to make sure that there is a basis that they can go ahead and get these things successfully to market, which meant that they had to price low. Now, this is very much the situation with CYBG, or Clydesdale, I think is perhaps most people would know it, the spin-off from the National Australia Bank. Well, it was delayed by a day because there was rumours circulating about a possible credit rating downgrade. Well, nevertheless, the shares did eventually price at 180 pence yesterday, and the shares have been trading conditionally on a good 10% premium to that this morning. The offer price, of course, at 0.56 times book value was always cheap. So even though Moody's did formally come out this morning with this one-notch downgrade, the market hasn't paid so much attention. It's saying it's value there, and it's probably on that basis cheapest chips. So there we have it. That's one piece of relief, a 10% premium. At least it was an earlier trading.
What's the ticker there, Barry, again? So the ticker code? What was that?
I wonder what it is. I haven't got my Bloomie in front of me right now. Okay, I think it's probably CYBG, because that's the full name of it.
Okay, I'll have a search for that. No worries.
Yeah. Now, otherwise, Shield Therapeutics is one we had expected would have closed by now. It hasn't. I mean, this is a good company. I've met the management. They come across very, very well indeed. It's a market-ready pharmaceutical group with a new product in iron deficiency. This is a very important area for the NHS. And that's not just the NHS, I should say globally for medical therapy. Now, the situation is that I think now that will probably close tomorrow. And the other one, which closed already, this is CMC Markets. This is the retail offer. That closed yesterday. And chatting around, we don't actually know what the outcome is yet, but the gossip seems to be that it was twice subscribed. And let's face it, it's got such an obvious peer in IG Group. I think that one should actually be quite nicely supported in early trade as well. And that leaves us with Countryside Properties. That's one which we as a house have quite a bit of interest in. It's another retail offer. This one remains open until, I think, midday on the 10th of February. I think it's got a nice portfolio, not only traditional house building, but also defensive partnership arrangements. These are long-term arrangements for urban renewal with councils, largely in the London boroughs. But that does provide a very sure place to be if you're worried, and let's face it, you have to be worried at some stage because the housing market is notoriously cyclical. It is still on the upswing, and quite honestly, we think we have a two-year vision on that. But a bit further out, you could see the clouds gathering, and I think on that basis, this would be the kind of defensive stock you would want in your construction portfolio if you keep such a thing.
Yeah. Okay, all right. So, and we mentioned Motive Bio and Advanced Oncotherapy last week. I hold stocks, shares in Advanced Oncotherapy, and they had a bit of a rally, and Motive Bio. So, any stocks this week you're looking at, Barry, in the secondary market?
Yeah, let's take a look at a couple of things. I mean, I do agree, Avo and Motive Bio, real favourites of mine. I know the management very well, and they are the top-notch guys, without any doubt at all. I'm really, really impressed with that. And they're on my list for buy it and hold it for 2016. Don't look at the daily volatility, because of course these things don't have great liquidity, so it's easy to see them pushed 5 or 10% on a day-by-day basis. Buy them today, look at your portfolio in 12 months' time. You should have a very big smile on your face. And on that basis, I'm going to add one other company to this list, and this is a company called MySquare. Now, this is a rather unique vehicle in the
I've heard of these. Yes, I mean, do you know what? They're on my watch list already, Barry. So, go ahead.
Well, it's a very unique vehicle in social media. Not that there's anything new in social media. Of course, the technology for social media is well tried and rolled out and trusted. No problems at all. But of course, in the online world, timing is everything. And MySquare itself has clearly seized first mover advantage in what is almost certainly the world's very, very last telecom frontier. And by that, I mean Burma, or Myanmar, as it's now called. Now, of course, Myanmar is riding on a wave of democracy. Aung San Suu Kyi, the wonderful lady of Burma, of course, succeeded to power. Now, basically, she's just convened her first parliament. I think for various technical reasons, she's not actually allowed to take the role as premier, but she's undoubtedly the power behind that throne. And really, what they will do is take a very young, excitable, and really hard-working population and bring it into the real world. I think what will happen in Burma, Myanmar, over the next 10 years is what basically Vietnam, which is a very similar country with similar people, with similar characteristics, what they took 30 years to do. And leading this, of course, is telecommunications and social media. Having released itself from a stranglehold, an economic stranglehold, I mean, for the last 50 years, of course, Myanmar doesn't come with any legacy system. So it doesn't have your old mainframes, it doesn't have your desktops, it doesn't have a 2G. It's going straight into 3G, 4G ready systems. And that means this exceptionally young population is able now to go straight on to 3G, 4G ready, buying Chinese made smartphones on the streets in Yangon for $30 a piece. And nothing more that they want to do than to get onto social media. And of course, MySquare is the only Burmese language social media network, and of course in Burma only 4% of the population actually speak an international language, and I mean in particular English or American. So you really have to be local language, and that's the key for them. That's why within 12 months of opening they've gone from 0 to 2 million account users, and the situation is accelerating dramatically, as well as the fact that they're monetizing it through gambling, through advertising, through other standard platforms on a standard rollout basis. There's no secret how to do it. It's just that they're in the right place at the right time. And for me, of course, two things stand out. One, I can't believe it, but it's trading below IPO price, despite the fact that they have massively more than delivered on promises over the past year. And two, of course, the situation is based on their current level of growth, they'll be not 2 million as they were in December this year of account users, they'll be probably double that or even more. Now, why I say 4 million is important, because that's the point at which the international social media hubs, these are the American companies, the Korean, the Japanese, they're running global hubs, they're looking for new virgin territories to go, they're exceptionally deep-pocketed. They see it, they want it, they've got the money to pay for it. And what they're going to see is an operator which has that 4 million number. That's the key number. That's when they'll take a look. And I think, quite honestly, a share price where it is right now, well, as I say, it IPO'd at 10 pence. If there is going to be an approach for this company, you can bet your bottom dollar they'll get a very good multiple. I can imagine 10 times that to even get a raised eyebrow from the management. And when I'm talking management here, I'm talking top-notch, a really powerful board. Remember, Piers Pottinger himself, that's the founder of Bell Pottinger, is the chairman of MySquare. That's one company you want to put on the list, without a doubt.
Yeah, it's on my list, but you know, I noticed it did shoot back at the 10 pence. It's got a volatile share price, so it's almost like put it on your watch list, and if you've done your research, you know, almost try and grab a good price, because like I say, it's quite volatile, but definitely they've got a cornered market there, which is very interesting in the social media space. But Barry, thank you for coming on. That's great stuff. Speak next week, hopefully.
Okay, all the best then. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Andrew Bell, Executive Chairman of Red Rock Resources. Thank you for coming on again, Andrew.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's all right. Well, I have a couple of private investors said, can you get Andrew on to talk about what's happening at Red Rock? So, Andrew, before you go ahead and talk about what's going on, can you tell us what Red Rock Resources are all about, please?
Well, Red Rock Resources has been listed on AIM for a certain number of years, since it came on at the time a lot of companies did in the mid-2000s. Unlike most of them, it still survives. We have had some vicissitudes over the last few years, as has most of the companies in the sector. We are in the resource sector. We are an explorer. And we have had some production directly in gold in Colombia and indirectly manganese in South Africa. However, the value of everything has gone down the last few years, and some of the projects we were exploring, of course, at current mineral prices, no longer look economic. We have diversified into oil and taken participations in producing oil wells, or about to be producing oil wells, in the southern United States, where the cost of production is very low, because we think that the financing model for AIM has changed and that we want to have cash flow so that we're not dependent on the market for revenues.
Okay,
cash.
Yeah, cash. So take us through the situation now in America there. What's exactly happening there?
Well, we've invested in Schoetz Creek. This is a field where some other companies are invested, notably Northcutt, which is also AIM-listed, and we have participated in that in what we think are advantageous terms in one well called the LM, or Lachamore 20, which has started producing, and an announcement came out on that in the last few days. And we are going to be participating equally 20% in a couple of other wells, which will be step-outs from the LM20. These are accessing the Frio horizon, which is between East Texas and Louisiana. It's relatively shallow. When the oil price was very high, everyone was looking for deeper horizons with more pressure and perhaps less water, where they could get large-scale production. But in this environment, something where you can be producing oil at $10 a barrel or less, even if not in huge quantities, is highly attractive. And as I say, you know, we get direct participation in the cash flow from this. So we've invested in one. We are expecting to participate in two more in the very near future. So that'll be three producing wells from the Frio formation.
Okay, all right. Well, let's go through some of the questions from private investors. You may be able to answer some, you may not, but we'll try them out. First one. What is the current cash burn per month or per annum of Red Rock Resources?
If you are talking about peer administration, we are somewhere near 30,000, but we'll be going down quite sharply. We're continuing to go down quite sharply as a result of measures being taken.
Okay, and that's 30,000 per month, yeah?
Yes.
Okay. The next question is, can you, and I suppose there's no guarantees here, but it says, can you guarantee there'll be no more equity dilution via placings?
Well, dilution is, dilution is sometimes, if you're talking about dilution of your percentage interest in a company, then, of course, if shares are issued and you don't participate, you're diluted. If you're talking about a dilution in your economic interest, then of course it depends whether the assets being bought, if you issue shares, are worth more than the average of the current assets or less. And if you are talking about dilution of the liquid assets or income situation of the company, that's different again, because it may be that a company has assets of, say, £10 million in its balance sheet, but £8 million of them are highly illiquid and there's only £2 million. In that case, to raise money to go into very liquid assets that would be producing cash flow and would be increasing profit would be anti-dilutive in a sense. So one can be raising money in an anti-dilutive way if one is buying at the bottom of the market assets that are very attractive, have growth and have income. We have stated as our general policy that we would not wish to issue shares except to buy revenue producing assets where we can directly look at the cost of the money and the internal rate of return on the assets and say this is a good deal. It would be foolish of us to say we'd never do that, because that's how one of the ways in which companies grow. But our strong preference is to finance ourselves through sale of assets, and we have been doing that. And when we get revenues, we will be financing ourselves from revenues. But in order to get accelerated growth, if we are making decisions and in the bear market, the decisions don't help, there's virtually nothing you can do. But when the market starts to recover, or there are, when it's at the bottom and there are opportunities, then if you're good at making decisions and doing analysis on things, the decisions made can add a lot of value, and some of them may require the issue of shares. So no current plan. We have been financing ourselves for quite a number of months from asset sales. We are now invested in projects that are starting to produce cash flow, and we have more money coming in February. There's an installment payment on the sale of Colombia. We have potentially more money in relation to Colombia. Beyond that, we do not see ourselves as primarily being financed from issues this year.
Okay, all right. So, next question. Why have you and the company consistently fallen below expectations, as illustrated by the destruction of the share price?
Anybody who is at all familiar with the sector will know that this is not something that could be said only about us. It's applied to everybody in the sector. It's true, things have been worse than we expected, and therefore the destruction of shareholder value has been greater than we expected. But every company in our sector has seen destruction of shareholder value. And given that we have not been income producing, and that we are relatively small, and that our project tended to be at an early stage, that has affected us more than other people. The important thing is that whereas most people haven't survived, we have survived. And while we survive and are able to retain assets that have long-term merit through the bottom of the market, then there is the inbuilt potential for appreciation.
Okay, and you said that the priority very much now is on cash flow, is that right?
Absolutely, yes.
And when will this cash be coming onto the balance sheet then?
Well, from disposal, we managed to turn around by bringing in investors and diversifying out of mining the company in which we had a major holding in Australia. We've been selling most of that so far, have a little bit left to sell, and we have sold Colombia, and we're about to get another installment payment in the middle of this month. Also, I expect that we will accelerate all or part of the $1 million convertible note, because one of the conditions for that was that if the acquirer became in any form listed, which it has become, then we would immediately have a liquidity event. The cash flow from the oil well and the two succeeding oil wells in the United States that we are already involved in, then we will have to see that. At the moment, we are just in the first well, the LM20, at the stage where we're starting to produce. We have, and the operators have it's not just a mechanical exercise of switching on a tap. You have to get to know the well, you have to look at the factors that are affecting flow, you have to optimize that flow by one or two measures, and when it first starts to flow, it doesn't flow in the way that it will after a week or two. So we will know within a week or two how far below or above our expectations that flow rate is, but it's certainly going to be quite good, and we'll start to get income through from that relatively shortly.
Okay. Next question is, what is happening with Kenya?
We had an issue in that our local partner had its licences purportedly cancelled by the government, but would, before any action was able to be taken to follow up that in-principle decision, we were able to go to the court in conjunction with the local partner and obtain a stay, and we've applied for remedies of certiorari, mandamus and prohibition, and that case is going through the courts. We expect to prevail. We would ideally find some compromise before the final hearing in court, because that will speed things up and get the ministry on side. There has been a change in minister, and we've met the new minister, and we believe that the wish of the government is, as evinced by him, is to sort out the issues that remain with a number of companies. We are not the only company that has gone to court or had problems in the last few months. And in the interim, because we were financing these legal proceedings, not that they were very expensive, we were able to increase our percentage in our local partner.
Okay, all right. Next question. An RNS in December stated that YA Global was still owed £80,000. Is that still the case? And are YA Global free to convert this into shares?
It is true in both cases. Yes, the answer is yes to both. However, we had them in our office just last week, and I was talking to someone there who was actually in our office this morning. And there is no current intention to convert, and we are going to manage that process very carefully.
Okay, all right. Next question is from the same person. When Aminex sold Schutz Creek in 2014, a production payment was due of around $4.5 million. How much will Red Rock Resources' revenues from Schutz Creek be affected by the payment? Surely someone has to pay it to Aminex.
We have no payment obligation to Aminex, have no participation in that. I'm not sure that those facts are absolutely correct, but it is not something that affects our position or our revenue stream in any way.
Okay. How will Red Rock Resources' revenues from Schutz Creek be affected by the payment? Next question. Sorry, I just repeated that, the end question. What is the position regarding gas sales from Schutz Creek? How much will gas infrastructure cost?
Honestly, I think that gas is a sideshow, and I don't think we should be factoring in anything for gas revenues. If there are gas revenues, they'll be very slight.
Okay.
Not least because the gas price is particularly low.
Yeah. Okay, Red Rock Resources invested around $94,000 in infrastructure in Schultz Creek. Will it receive this investment back before the NRI in LM20 is reduced to 11.7%?
This is correct. And the requirement for return of capital before the back-in starts extends across all three wells. Therefore, it's across all three wells in aggregate, not individually.
I see. Next question. Is Red Rock close to making any further investments? And if so, how would they be funded?
Red Rock is not at present close to making further investment. I will be at the NAEP oil and gas conference in Houston next week, as will my colleague. And we will undoubtedly see a lot of people, and that may lead in time to some very good opportunities, given the state of the market and the desperation that some people will be feeling. If this is, as projects we've looked at in the past, it will be many, many months before we get to the stage of making decisions, feeling comfortable with the situation, and potentially making an investment. But you can never tell.
Yeah, okay. Regarding the reinstatement of the Migori licenses, how confident is Andrew that the court's decision will rule in his favour? And if the licences are renewed, what is the next step envisaged?
The point about this that a lot of people mistake is that this is not a hearing on the merits. This is an administrative hearing. It is about the appropriateness of the procedures carried out by the decision maker and whether they observed their own procedures and the rule of law. We expect to prevail because our case is exceptionally strong.
Okay, well, we've covered all the questions there, Andrew. So if you could, give us three reasons why someone should look about doing some more research into Red Rock Resources.
Well, I think, first of all, our cash flow model is quite good. We have revenues coming through from very cheap oil production. It's much better to be getting into the oil sector when the price is $30 than when it's $100, because almost every decision you take is going to be right, not just short-term, but long-term. Secondly, we have some very good long-term assets, which are probably in each individually worth more than the current market capitalization, that over time that value will come out. I'd give just one example. Through Jupiter Mines, our stake in the Chipi manganese mine in South Africa, that's one of the largest, longest life, lowest cost manganese mines in the world. And thirdly, I think the gold price is recovering, and we have some useful gold assets, not just in Kenya, but also through our royalty on the Colombian asset we sold, and through some exploration applications in Ivory Coast or granted tenements there, we have exposure and potential exposure to gold. So that's just three reasons. I could produce more, but three will do for now.
Thank you very much, Andrew, for coming on. I mean, it was at the request of some private investors, and you responded swiftly. So thanks for coming on. And
You had a lot of questions, and we covered a lot of questions in a short time. So that's really good. Thank you.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks, Andrew. Speak soon.
Okay, bye.
Okay, today's stock with potential is suggested by Oil Man. And I've got to say, I do hold a bit of stock in this company. And I've taken a bath on it. Really am underwater on this company. I bought at the wrong time on a spike. Like I said, this is always a learning process, you know. I bought at the committee, right? Even though I believe the stock has potential, I bought at the wrong time. Like I said, you can buy a good company at the wrong price and you can be underwater. You can buy a bad company at the right price and make money. But if you buy a good company at a good price, you're on to hopefully a long-term winner there. But anyway, the company is Hague and London Oil. HNL is the ticker. What does the company do? It's oil and gas. Would you say this company is a short, medium, or long-term investment? Medium to long. How many shares does the company have in issue? 24 million. Not a lot in free float there. What's the current price and market cap? So it's 6 pence. Market cap is 1.45 million. No revenue. How much cash does it or debt does the company have? It has 950,000. That was of June 2015, so it's probably less than that. Like I said, do your own research there. Go to the website, check it out, look at the RNSs there, and read through that. List three reasons you think this company has potential. Number one, the Dayung PSC offshore Indonesia has 902 BCF of gas discovery close to energy-hungry markets. Any gas sales agreement will be around $6 MMSCF and could be funded by Ford selling gas. Reason two, broker has a net asset value of 59 pence for the company, and net asset of Dayung alone of 300 million when gas first comes on stream. That is 143 times the market cap of the company. Listen, do your own research. Number three, led by Andrew Cochrane, who has founded two companies that sold for $750 million combined and was on the board of one company that sold for $2.3 billion. So that's Hague and London Oil, HNL. I have done an article on this, a blog post on this, but like I said, I think I'm about 50% down on this company. But there we are. You know, I bought at the wrong time. That's it. I did research, but I still bought at the wrong time. There's so many factors involved in buying shares. You know, that's why it's a huge learning process. So if you think you know of a stock with potential, please get involved with this feature. Go to sharepickers.com or go to voxmarkets.co.uk/blog and you can see all the previous blogs there. And don't forget, if it's before 4:30 today on a Thursday, go to voxmarkets.co.uk/OPS and have a guess in our oil price sweepstake. It's free and you may win some dollars.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
People in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Don't buy anything based solely on tip or recommendation you hear. Please do your own research.